I'm sure all of us at some point have had times in our lives where we have maybe spent extra time on a project. Maybe we've been so focused on it, so zoned in on it, that maybe we've neglected other responsibilities in favor of that particular project. There are times where we have to balance priorities. There are times where sometimes temporarily you have to maybe spend more time doing this than something else in order to take care of emergency issues and things like that. It's all about dividing up our time and our attention when it comes to physical responsibilities. But there are times where, as Christians, what should be taking place is a overarching devotion to God and a recognition that my service to God comes first and then everything else comes second, where we are tempted and we see others perhaps in the religious community who actually sometimes allow physical matters of life to take the place where really God needs to be. Sometimes people can become so obsessed over one particular aspect of life. Maybe it's a job, some responsibility, some project, something that they become so focused on, obsessed with, that they don't even care that they're neglecting things that they need to be doing, and especially when it comes to serving God. In Leviticus chapter 26 and in verse 1, God gives a commandment to the children of Israel. God says, "You shall not make idols for yourselves, neither a carved image nor a sacred pillar shall you bring up for yourselves, nor shall you set up an engraved stone in your land to bow down to it, for I am the Lord your God." In Exodus chapter 20, part of the Ten Commandments, "You shall have no other gods before me," God said. When we consider the commandment of not having any other gods before him, we typically think about idols and we think about idolatry. And certainly that was a way in which the children of Israel fell on a regular occasion, it seems, throughout their history. Whether it was Baal or Asherah, there was always something better. When they first came out of Egypt, they were looking back to Egypt. When we consider the idea of what it means to have an idol, I want to define what that term means. The modern definition of this is a person or thing that is regarded with blind adoration, admiration, or devotion. Vines from Acts chapter 14 defines it this way, and this is where Paul and Barnabas have come to a city and they're being praised as Zeus and Hermes. Vine says that that term in the New Testament for gods or idols, a phantom or likeness, a vain thing. So I want you to consider with me what it is as God has given the commandment in times past, and it continues to always be so, that you shall have no other gods before me. In what ways that can apply to our lives? First is the obvious. We've looked at Leviticus chapter 26 and in verse 1, and Exodus chapter 20 and in verse 3, "You shall have no other gods before me." Verse 4, "You shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is on the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them to serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me." Notice how God, at the end of this, as Moses has given this to the children of Israel, God has given it to Moses to give to them, and he describes the act of worshiping an idol as hating Jehovah, as bowing down and serving an idol as hating Jehovah. In essence, what Jehovah says is, it's me and me only. And what's interesting about this is often in the Old Testament, idols and graven images are set apart. They're two different things. In fact, usually throughout the Old Testament, it's idols and graven images. not all one thing, but as if they're two different things. Because in Israel's history, time and time again, there were times where they fell into worshiping idols, yes. But there were also times where they worshiped graven images as well at the same time. When Elijah proposed this test at Mount Carmel to say, if Baal is God, then serve him. If Jehovah is God, then serve him. He gave them this ultimatum, this you need to make a decision. When he did that, he said, you cannot continue to serve both. Right now, you're serving both. Idols within the Old Testament were things that were created that represented false gods. The golden calf that just happened to come out when Aaron was involved in helping the children of Israel set up a new god while Moses was receiving the Ten Commandments. But then there were other times in which even the graven images were made in order to represent Jehovah. That is condemned as well. It wasn't just gods in the shape of a cow. It was also any images meant to, hey, this is Jehovah. This is what Jehovah is. God says, you worship me the way I tell you to. In Acts chapter 12 and in verse 22, in addition to condemning images that man crafts and associating some sort of divine existence on it, in Acts chapter 12 and in verse 22, in the context where Herod is entertaining the people of Tyre and Sidon, and they are praising him, and he's accepting praise from him, from them. Verse 22, the people kept shouting, the voice of a god and not of a man. And of course, we know what happens to Herod here in Acts chapter 12, where he is struck by the Lord and he is eaten by worms. In Acts chapter 14 and in verse 11, when Paul comes to Laconia, the people saw what Paul had done. They raised their voices, saying in the Laconian language, the gods have come down to us in the likeness of men. And they were praising them and wanted to sacrifice to them because they saw them as Zeus and Hermes, Paul and Barnabas. And of course, we'll note here in a little while exactly how Paul and Barnabas reacted to this. In Acts chapter 28 and in verse 6, after, spoiler alert, in our adult class, the ship that Paul's on is going to shipwreck. And in verse 6, after Paul is on this island and he's bitten by a snake, the people who are native of that island expected Paul to die. Verse 6, however, they were expecting he would swell up or suddenly fall down dead. But after they had looked for a long time, saw no harm come to him, they changed their minds and said that he was a god. This is something Paul experienced on at least two occasions we see. But over and over again, especially in the context of how the saints, how Paul handled these situations, no man is to be revered or worshipped. Remember what our definition was: a person or thing regarded with blind admiration, adoration, or devotion. This is where Paul and Barnabas, that's why they reacted the way that they did in Acts chapter 14. Here in verse 6, of course, Paul, this group of natives, they didn't know who Paul was. They hadn't heard about the gospel yet, and it's an opportunity for Paul to talk to them about it. But when he didn't die by being bit by a snake, they said, well, he must be divine. And the condemnation from the Old through the New Testament, certainly the graven images, the idols meant to represent some other gods. But man is not to be worshipped as a god either. Even on occasions where we see angels, there are times like in Revelation where John bows to the angel. And the angel says, no, don't bow to me. There's occasion where Peter, he makes the same statement. We see in Acts chapter 3, after he healed the lame man, that they're all focused on him. And Peter says, why are you marveling at me? As if I did this. The focus is always on Jehovah. In Acts chapter 14 and in verse 14, when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard this, they tore their clothes and ran in among the multitude, crying out, "Men, why are you doing these things? We also are men with the same nature as you. And we preach to you that you should turn from these useless things to the living God, who made the heaven, the earth, the sea, and all things that are in them." Paul and Barnabas, they deal with both of them. Turn from these useless things. Why are you approaching us as if we're some sort of deity? So we're men just like you. Turn from these, Paul calls them useless, Paul and Barnabas call them useless things. And that's why vines, in context to that, refers to a phantom or likeness, a vain thing. But when we consider how God has established the commandment, both from the Old Testament all the way through, even into the New Testament, of recognizing that our devotion, our admiration, and our adoration needs to be towards Him and Him alone, applications start coming down from this. Generally speaking, a lot of times we think in our society that we're a bit removed from the ways of old, from idolatry days like they had in Canaan. But the truth is, idols are still very much a part of today's society, even in America. From this strict idea of recognizing something as being worth worship or veneration, think about Buddha. They're literally other gods that people serve. And these aren't small groups of people either. Millions and millions of people that serve false gods, not just claiming them to be Jehovah. They are false gods. But then when someone takes Jehovah's name but applies false characteristics to Jehovah, time and time again, even in our public media, in TV shows, movies, and so forth, you'll hear references to Allah as if Allah and Jehovah are the same God. There was an episode of NCIS a couple years back. It was in reference to that concept where the statement was made, Allah, Jehovah, they're the same God. They're not the same God. Because when people overlay characteristics onto Jehovah and say, this is who Jehovah is, when Jehovah says, no, this is what I am, you create a false God. At no time does our God, Jehovah, ever say death to the infidels. In fact, he says he loves all. He sent his son to die for all. And when it comes to worshiping or venerating men on this earth as having some special, needing to pay special attention to an individual, we have examples like the Pope. There are different religions that have their priests that are venerated. Men who maybe don't claim to be deity, but they are worshipped almost as if they were. It's no different. I can picture Paul and Barnabas reacting the same way to some of the situations where men receive the praise and the adoration and the veneration, being priests or bishops and whatnot, popes. Paul and Barnabas rending their clothes. We are men just like you. But in addition to this, I propose another definition for an idol. A more encompassing definition for an idol. How about this? Any image, person, item, or concept that takes up such attention and or devotion as to distract a person from the service of God. If we were to define an idol based on how the Bible presents it, not just how modern definition uses it, but how the Bible presents what an idol is, this is more in line with an encompassing idea of an idol or idolatry. Because when you think about it, this opens it up not just to false gods, not just to trying to overlay Jehovah with characteristics that you want him to have rather than what he says he has. This applies in areas of life that sometimes we may not think about. In Colossians chapter 3 and in verse 5, Colossians chapter 3 and in verse 5, Paul tells the Colossians, "Therefore put to death your members which are on the earth, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. Because of these things, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience, in which you yourselves once walked when you lived in them." Paul's referring to the Colossians in the past tense. This is the way you used to be. But you're not like this anymore. But notice within that list of sinful activities and sinful desires, he says, covetousness, which is idolatry. Well, is it the strict definition like we think about in the Old Testament of having graven images and false gods? No. But that's why Paul mentions the idea of the character within a person, that it is just as bad or the same as idolatry. For instance, when we think about our jobs, there are people, and even Christians, who can fall into the trap of seeing their careers as being more important than anything. They may not necessarily have that thought process, but by their actions, that's what they say. When they give up spending time with their family or trying to help people, trying to go into worship, they give all that up in pursuit of their career because that's the most important thing to them. A job, a career can be an idol. When I am so focused on school because I got to get those straight A's, and I am willing to give up spending time with brethren or not going to worship, and I'm neglecting my responsibilities, I'm only focused on that one thing. Because after all, everybody in our society says, the grades, you need to make sure those grades are good. I want to get into this college, I need to have this certain number of activities on my resume, because that's the most important thing. See, there's a fine line between having projects, having responsibilities, dealing with things of this life that we need to deal with. We need to be able to provide for our families. We need to be able to get into college if that's the type of career choice we want to make that involves having a college education. All of those things are important. But by our actions, do we sometimes say, not only to others, but to God, that that's the most important? See, how we live, the decisions we make in association with those responsibilities goes a long way to speaking about what's in our heart. In Exodus chapter 18 and in verse 21, as Jethro speaking to Moses, and he's trying to help Moses de-stress a little. Moses has got a load on his shoulders. Jethro says, listen to my advice. Here's what you need to do. Moreover, you shall select from all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, who hate covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. Part of the advice that Jethro gives to Moses is you need to set up a system where there are judges in place to help deal with issues that come up among the people. But notice the characteristics of these men. These are men that fear God. They put God first. So they're not going to be thinking about their own selfish desires. They're putting what God wants us to do. And keep in mind, the Mosaic law served as much as a civil law as it did a spiritual law for Israel. Men of truth. They're not going to deny the truth. They're not going to entertain liars. They want truth. And in their judgments, they exalt the truth. Men who hate covetousness. And when I was thinking about this particular characteristic, the more I thought about it, the more I thought about, well, what would be the opposite of that? A judge who loved covetousness. who had a desire for all kinds of material possessions, do you think maybe he might be compromised? Not only in his judgment, but perhaps even being susceptible to bribery? See, the focus is on the truth. In fact, in many ways, men of truth is contrasted to covetousness. These men hate covetousness. Their focus is not on what I can gain, but on making sure we judge righteously. In Luke chapter 12 and in verse 13, someone comes to Jesus and asks or says, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." To which Jesus in verse 14 says, "Hey, I'm not a judge over you. I'm not an arbitrator. I'm not the one you need to come to divide that up. That's a lawful thing." But in verse 15, Jesus says, "Take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses." Jesus isn't saying that it's okay to let people run all over you and take advantage of you. That's not necessarily the case. It's not that, well, should that brother, was it rightful for the brother to be willing to share the inheritance? Sure. Jesus is speaking, though, to the heart and the character of one whose entire focus, that seems to be what the situation here is. Instead of, out of all the times in the Gospels, we've seen examples of people coming to him, "Teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Teacher, what must I do to be saved?" This man comes and says, "Teacher, I want my money from my brother. Can you tell him to give it to me, please?" That's what he asks Jesus to do. It is to that character that Jesus is speaking. Listen, there are more important things than your inheritance. Now, maybe this man has a family and he needs that inheritance to help support his family. Fine. But you're speaking to the Son of God. And even if he didn't realize that, they certainly, people who hadn't yet come to the realization that this is the Son of God, recognized Jesus as a rabbi, a teacher. They should have known what to ask him with a proper heart. This man didn't have a proper heart. And it is to that which Jesus says, one's life does not consist. Does that mean in our lives there are things that we possess? Sure. But our lives do not revolve, nor is there any ultimate conclusion of having possessions. That's one of the things we're learning in Ecclesiastes on Wednesday nights. That even Solomon, after observing the natural course of man, that the rich man dies and so does the poor man. The wise man dies, so does the fool. It doesn't make any difference. All die, and you can't take it with you. And yet I heard someone say one time, I heard a Christian say this. Unfortunately, this was a member of my family. I like to think they changed their mind eventually. They said, "Life is a game, and money is how you keep score." I want you to think about that for a minute. Life is a game, and money is how you keep score. That's not the mind of a Christian. That's the mind of somebody who cares more about the physical things than the things of God. It is that character, that mindset to which Jesus is speaking in verse 15. Life doesn't consist. No, in essence, Jesus says, life is not about money. It is not how you keep score. Beware of covetousness. In 1 Timothy chapter 6 and in verse 9, Paul writes to Timothy and says, "But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows." Not only is the covetousness characteristic condemned, having a love of money, but Paul also deals with what can come from it. How far will people go because they love money? How many, some of these crime shows that some of us enjoy watching, NCIS and others, how many of them revolve around paydays? "Oh, my ship's coming in." That's the phrase they let people like to use. And they go, they'll go do something that's completely out of character for them because it's just this one time and I'll have $1 million. The desire for money creeps into the consciousness because of the way our society functions. It favors people of means because money is the means to power in society. That's the way it's always been. It's the way it always will be. But that's why Paul warns Timothy to warn the brethren that the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Not just covetousness of itself, but even the things that come from it. Many stray in their faith because of their pursuit, because of their greed. And they pierce themselves through. Picture that for a minute. Think about what Paul's saying. They've pierced themselves. It's as if these brethren have taken a bow and arrow and have somehow turned it around and shot themselves with an arrow, not even realizing that's what they were doing. That's how Paul's. They've pierced themselves through with many sorrows because that is what they're after. They're after money. They love their possessions. They love their wealth. Or they want it, even if they don't yet have it. And in doing so, they fall into so many traps. In Psalm 119 and in verse 34, the psalmist says, "Give me understanding, and I shall keep your law. Indeed, I shall observe it with my whole heart. Make me walk in the path of your commandments, for I delight in it. Incline my heart to your testimonies," verse 36, "and not to covetousness. Turn away my eyes from looking at worthless things, and revive me in your way. Establish your word to your servant who is devoted to fearing you." What was one of our definitions for idols, a person or thing regarded with blind admiration, adoration, or devotion? And our psalmist makes the statement that he delights in the commandments of God, "Incline my heart to your testimonies," as opposed to what? As opposed to covetousness. He wants his eyes not to be focused on worthless things. Remember what one of our definitions was from Vines? Vain thing. Establish your word to your servant who is devoted to what? Serving yourself? Seeking money? No, I'm devoted to fearing you. The psalmist helps us to recognize what's sometimes the source of idolatry. When it comes to covetousness as being a form of idolatry, it's a lack of focus. It's a lack of proper perspective. And this is why Ecclesiastes is such a great book to study, to remind us of having the proper perspective as human beings on this earth. In Ezekiel chapter 33 and in verse 29, God speaks to Ezekiel. He says, "Listen to me. This is what I'm going to do to the people." Verse 29, "They shall know that I am the Lord, when I have made the land most desolate because of all their abominations which they have committed." Verse 30, "As for you, son of man, the children of your people are talking about you beside the walls and in the doors of the houses, and they speak to one another, everyone saying to his brother, 'Please come and hear what the word is that comes from the Lord.'" That sounds good. They should be doing that, right? Notice how God, what he says in verse 31. God says, "So they come to you as people do. They sit before you as my people. They hear your words, but they do not do them. For with their mouth they show much love, but their hearts pursue their own gain. Indeed, you are to them as a very lovely song of one who has a pleasant voice and can play well on an instrument. For they hear your words, but they do not do them. And when this comes to pass, and surely it will come, then they will know that a prophet has been among them."
God accuses his people of having a double heart, saying, oh, they seem to be into listening to you and into hearing what you have to say, and they seem like they're taking it to heart, but they're not actually doing it. And this is a danger. This is a danger for every one of us. Because sometimes we can deceive ourselves into thinking, as long as I'm, for instance, at worship, and I'm sitting there in Bible study and I'm hearing it, and I'm sitting there during the sermon and I'm hearing it, well, then that counts for something. But unless I do it, unless I put it into practice in my life, it counts for nothing. This is the danger of covetousness. This is the danger of idolatry. Well, how does idolatry and covetousness get into the way or get into the mindset of one who isn't applying God's word after they leave the church building? It gets in there because more important things are on people's minds. That's how it works. More important things, a lot of times we talk about, and I'm not saying this is the wrong thing to say, but sometimes, especially on Wednesday night, we refer to Wednesday night as taking a break from our busy lives to be able to come together with people of faith and to study. And that's absolutely right. But I want to emphasize, though, the danger of thinking that our lives and our busy schedule is what we're doing most of the time, and we're just going to take a little time out for you, God. But then we're going to go back to our busy schedules. That's not what we're doing. Because in the end, we never take a time out for God, because we're living for God every day. Yes, our schedules, we have things going, things coming, but those are not as important as serving God. Whether it's Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, or every minute of every day. That is the danger of idolatry. And when we allow things, no matter what it may be, video games, TV, it could be jobs, it could be school, it could be sports, it could be recreational activities, whatever it is, it comes between me and serving God, whether it's on the Lord's Day or during any day of the week, it's idolatry. In Hebrews chapter 13 and in verse 5, let your conduct, this is the way I live, let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have, for he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Notice the commitment that the Hebrew writer brings up from God. Here's the commitment that God has made. I will never leave you nor forsake you, which is to say, I will always take care of what's important for you. That does not mean that we're always going to have all the money we want, the best house we want, the cars we want, the clothes we want. That's not what that means. What it means is, I know what's best for you, and I will never leave you or abandon you as long as you trust in me. That's why the Hebrew writer makes the application from that promise of God, let your conduct be without covetousness, because there's no need for it. Be content with such things as you have. God has given them to you. And if you are covetous, here's what's written between the lines there in verse 5. If you are covetous, you're coveting, you're telling God, God, what you've given me is not enough. Be content with such things. God has given you these things. Does that mean I can't plan for a better future? Go to school and get a degree? Can't plan for a better future? No, that's not what he's saying. He's saying that be content. That term content means I am sufficient. God has made me sufficient for today. I am sufficient today. God has blessed me today. I'm alive because of God today. Let your conduct be without covetousness, because if your conduct is with covetousness, you're telling God you're not enough. In Acts chapter 14 again, but earlier now in verse 11. In the end, when we think about idols, and we think about man's obsession with ritual, throughout history, when it comes to quote-unquote religion outside of what God has commanded, This goes all the way back to the Old Testament and into the New Testament. Man has always had a tendency to make things feel holy. That's what man wants a lot of times. They want things to feel holy. To feel as if this is some sort of special ritual, and the ritual or the words, these have some sort of special power and meaning. In Acts chapter 14, the example of the Laconians, people saw what Paul had done when he healed a lame man. They raised their voices, verse 11, saying in the Laconian language that gods have come down to us in the likeness of men. So they're calling Barnabas Zeus and Paul Hermes, verse 12. And in verse 13, the priest of Zeus, whose temple was in front of their city, brought oxen and garlands to the gates, intending to sacrifice with the multitudes. Notice what the people said in verse 11. And this, I think, in some way or form, in many cases, I think that this is the ultimate goal of man. He wants to be able to touch God. He wants to see God. The gods have come down in the likeness of men. Here's God. In Acts 17, when Paul was at Mars Hill, when Paul, verse 22, stands in the midst of the Areopagus and says, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are very religious. For as I was passing through and considering the objects of your worship, I even found an altar with this inscription to the unknown God." All of the gods of the Greek pantheon, and then one extra just in case there was somebody we missed. Man has yearned to be able to be with his God. That is something that is deeply rooted within man's nature. And rightfully so. Because isn't that what we're hoping to do one day? Be with God? To see God? To be in his presence? That's why heaven is so important. To be with him for all eternity. But society after society, generation after generation, they don't want to do it the way God has said. They want to do it their own way. And so they make up these rituals. They make up all of this pomp and circumstance and holy feelings to make it feel like I'm a part and connected to God somehow. That is often the source of idolatry when it comes to literal idols. Man has always believed in something greater than himself. Throughout history, there's never been a civilization that did not believe in some higher being or beings. There's a reason for that. Because in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and Adam and Eve knew God. But then after the garden, Abel was dead, Cain and Seth, they have children, their children have children, and through the generations they forgot God. Then God started over with Noah and his family. And so Noah, his three sons, and their three wives, they start over, they repopulate the earth, but then generation after generation comes, and they forget about Jehovah. And as Paul describes in Romans chapter 1, they stopped serving the Creator and started serving the creature because they wanted to touch God. They wanted to feel close to God. We need to make sure that we guard our hearts and minds when it comes to our devotion and admiration, commitment, our worship, our veneration. For most of us, this type of setting is what we think about when we think about worship. When we worship God, this is what we think about: singing praises to Him, taking the Lord's Supper. All the different elements of our worship service. What about the alternative to worship? What's the opposite of worship? Instead of exalting, you're bringing down and exalting something else in its place. That's what happens when we allow the affairs of this world, no matter what it may be, to take the place of God. Whether it's temporary or not, nothing is more important at any moment during the day than making sure we're serving God. The moment that changes and we allow our friends to influence us, our coworkers, our boss, our family to influence us, to allow something else to be more important to us in that moment, we're guilty. It happened to Peter, you remember? In those moments, there were three times, I don't know him. Yeah, you were with him. I don't know him. In that moment, Peter wasn't what he was supposed to be, even despite his claim prior, Lord, I'd die with you. Not in those three moments, he wasn't. It's important for us to guard our hearts because idolatry, covetousness, is so smooth, so deceitful. That's how Satan works. He slides it in there without you even realizing it until it's too late. Then you're addicted. That's the lesson for you this afternoon. I hope that some of this is beneficial for us to study and to look at and to bring these commandments. I've often said that 9 out of the 10 commandments that were given to the children of Israel are reinstituted in the New Testament. The only one that wasn't was keeping the Sabbath day holy. Now it's keeping the Lord's Supper holy on the first day of the week. But the recognition that we shall have no other gods before him, sometimes that doesn't really apply to us. Oh, it applies to us every single day. Let's maintain our hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. And if you need any help doing that, please let us know as we come forward and stand aside.